Hi, I'm Femi Oke. Thanks for watching the stream. One of the biggest news stories of our time is our global climate crisis, and that is why Al Jazeera is part of a global collective of journalists called Covering Climate Now. We bring you stories about climate all of the time so you can stay up to date. One of the biggest scandals in the climate emergency is the dark money that is filtered in to climate action to either slow it down or stop it. It sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it's actually fact, and that is what we're delving into today. US special interests versus climate action. We're going to be doing that with our guests. Hello, Michael, Rebecca, Charlie. Good to see all three of you. Michael, welcome to the stream. Please introduce yourself to our global audience.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm Michael Mann. I'm a professor at Penn State University and a climate researcher and also author of The New Climate War.
Good to have you. Hello there, Rebecca. Welcome to the stream. Welcome back to the stream. Remind our audience who you are, what you do.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Lieber. I'm a reporter on climate change at Vox.
Good to have you. And Charlie, hello. Introduce yourself to our global audience.
Hello, my name's Charlie Cray. I'm with Greenpeace USA, based in Washington, D.C.
Good to have you. So you have met all of your panel. If you're on YouTube right now, comment section is live. Your comments, your thoughts can be right here. This conversation is part of the Covering Climate Now and Democracy series. So we're linking up US special interests with democracy. What is the problem? What have you seen? Let us know. You're part of the show. Michael, I'm going to start with you because your recent book, The New Climate War, suggests that there is a battle going on. What is that war?
Yeah, so, you know, the old battle was this effort by fossil fuel interests and dark money groups, conservative foundations, conservative politicians and media outlets, this effort to deny that climate change is real. But people can see that it's real. People can see that it's happening now. And so that just isn't tenable anymore. That doesn't mean that the polluters and those promoting them have given up the battle. Instead, they've turned to other tactics, delay, deflection, division, even doom-mongering to convince us it's too late. That's what I call the new climate war.
Rebecca, as you're reporting this, it sounds like a thriller. It sounds like a conspiracy theory, but we have seen this before in the tobacco industry, and some of the same playbook tactics are being used in the fossil fuel industry to try and persuade the public that what they're seeing is not what they're seeing. Rebecca, how do you tell that story?
Exactly. This is a very similar playbook to what big tobacco used. But I think the most important thing about it is it keeps shifting, just like Michael said. This is no longer just a debate that climate deniers are trying to have over whether climate change is real or not. They're now shifting that to more obstruction and delay tactics. And just like we saw with tobacco companies, oil companies are intent on delaying climate action as long as possible.
Charlie, there's some work that the Greenpeace journalism arm did, which was they tracked down and found an ExxonMobil lobbyist. And I want to play a little clip of how he described his job, what he was doing, and then hear you talk about the damage that can be done by lobbyists in the fossil fuel industry. Let's have a listen. Let's have a look, first of all.
Did we aggressively fight against some of the science?
Yeah.
Yes. Did we hide our science? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Did we join some of these shadow groups to work against some of the early efforts? Yes, that's true. But there's nothing illegal about that.
Yeah.
You know, we were looking out for our investments. We were looking out for our shareholders.
That's exactly the playbook, a minor part of it, as Dr. Mann described. Lobbyists are crawling all over Washington, D.C. There's probably 10,000 registered corporate lobbyists in the fossil fuel industry, and some of the other interests that depend upon them politically, so to speak, are some of the most powerful on the Hill. We hear it all the time from Senator Whitehouse and some of the other senators and leaders who are trying to get climate-related legislation through and getting blocked at every turn. And so, you know, it's not surprising. And in fact, it's not just these companies themselves. They often operate through very powerful business trade associations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
We wanted to share with our audience some of the places the money is coming from. I'm not sure at this stage whether it's dark money. So, Charlie, you can tell me when I show this to you. Grant makers, I want to do that in air quotes. Donors
sure.
Trust, Charles Koch
Donors
Foundation.
Donors Trust, the
tell
Charles Koch Foundation. Mm-hmm. So those two, you know, are really primarily connected to Charles Koch and a whole network of billionaires and centimillionaires who use these foundations as kind of pass-throughs to fund a whole slew of nonprofits, other trusts, limited liability corporations, and the money cascades down to a whole network. And what ends up happening is the ultimate recipient, you don't know where their ultimate source of funding is. And that's why we call them dark money groups,
yeah,
because these entities don't really report their ultimate source of money. So Donors Trust, you don't know who their real funders are. They report who they give money to, but you don't know who gave them the money to give
those organizations. That's a really good point. Wow. Okay.
And so it's
that's
very different.
That's the
than
darkness.
Exxon.
Okay. Yeah, I get that. Let me just look then. Michael, please help me here. The groups receiving this money. So we don't know necessarily the source of the money. It comes from certain organizations and then goes to these specific groups, some of them, some of the big ones. Tell us about some of these so that we understand the way the money filters through the system.
Sure. So, you know, these are some of the usual suspects when it comes to climate change denialism: the Heritage Foundation, AEI, the Mercatus Center, Federalist Society. These are essentially laundering outfits. And so the dark money comes in, presumably from folks like the Koch brothers, from ExxonMobil and fossil fuel companies. It gets laundered through dark money to these organizations that serve as mouthpieces for promoting industry-friendly propaganda, climate change denial propaganda.
So, Rebecca, we have in the United States a newish administration who said part of their mandate was to address climate action, to address the climate emergency. How is that going? Has U.S. special interest disappeared because you have an administration that is saying that it's committed to climate change and climate action?
Yeah, this is dark money in action, basically, because we have a bill that it represents the most historic level of spending we could have in this country on climate change in over a decade. That's Build Back Better. But that bill has not passed the Senate, and that is largely because of a single senator, Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Now, going back to that video that you showed earlier of the Exxon lobbyist, I believe it was in that same video where Exxon was also bragging about its access to Joe Manchin in helping block this bill. So we still have not had this legislation pass into law, and you can trace that back to the money that's been spent to delay this legislation, shape the public messaging so that it doesn't pass, and also pressure lawmakers like Joe Manchin into not voting in favor for this bill.
I'm really glad you mentioned Joe Manchin because, going to say something? Go ahead.
I was going to add, yes. You know, we can't let the Republican Party have a pass here. I mean, Mike Lofgren, who was a 30-year staffer for a senator from Ohio, wrote a book called The Party's Over, came out before Trump. Mm-hmm. And he essentially described the Republican Party as an ideological cult. And what he means by that is that, you know, they don't take a stand on issues. They don't evaluate the facts. What they do is they're like a tribal herd that follows the ideological agenda. And so what happens is you can always count on them to vote against climate legislation. And so you have to get every single Democrat lined up. And when it's a thin margin, someone like Joe Manchin steps in and becomes incredibly pivotal and incredibly obstructive. Mm.
I'm going to share something with our audience in just a moment, but Michael, it looks like you've got something on your mind. Go ahead, yeah. Articulate it before I share this with our audience.
Sure thing. I agree with everything that both Rebecca and Charlie said here. And what's remarkable is that we've normalized the Republican Party. We take it as a given that they are going to oppose any efforts to do anything meaningful to address the climate crisis. It's sort of remarkable that it now falls on every single Democrat. And indeed, if just two of them, not just Joe Manchin, but Kristen Sinema in this case, wish to block the climate agenda, they're able to do so right now because of this Republican obstruction.
I am going to share something that I found on Rebecca's timeline on Twitter and also Charlie's timeline on Twitter. It was the coal baron blockade. So we've been talking about this dark money in the climate emergency, climate action, disrupting it. But there is a way, and there are ways, that citizens can say, hang on a minute, we need to organize. So we've been talking about Joe Manchin. He's a very well-known figure in the Democratic Party. But he also is in West Virginia that has a lot of coal mines, and there's a lot of special interest to make sure those coal mines stay producing coal. That's the setup. Now have a look at the pushback.
The truth is, he does not care about our futures. He cares about his future as a millionaire and as an oligarch.
He makes $500,000 a year from his coal company.
You should be ashamed to face constituents who are rationing their insulin to keep their lights on.
Shame!
You should be ashamed to face your constituents who have lost their jobs in the coal mines with no alternative in sight.
Shame!
You should be ashamed to face your constituents that only have a dying and a dirty coal plant to sustain their entire community.
Shame!
You should be ashamed because you have blood on your hands.
So, Charlie, here I am thinking about what you and Rebecca and Michael have been describing, which sounds like the forces of dark money, OK? I'm not going to say the forces of darkness, but the forces of dark money that are really derailing what is possible in climate action. But then we see a campaign like the coal baron blockade. How effective can that be? What is the answer to dark money in climate crisis?
Well, what we've seen in the course of history in this country anyway is that organized people can beat organized money. And that's exactly what's starting to happen here. It's what we see with the Sunrise Movement, many, many other groups.
I'm also going to bring in Michael, because Michael, part of your book is not just explaining what the war is, but also how the battle can be won. Help us with that. Explain.
Yeah, no, I agree with what Charlie just said. Look, collective action is extremely important here. We have a voice. Today, in the age of social media, we have these amazing platforms for speaking out and organizing. And look, the forces of darkness, and I'll call them that, the forces of inaction, I call them the inactivists in the book, the polluters and those doing their bidding, are very organized, and they have tried to hijack social media as a cause for the promotion of misinformation and disinformation. We've got to take that back. Yeah. We've got to use our voice. We've got to speak out in every way possible to hold those policymakers accountable.
And I'd like to just point to some other examples of the way people can take part. I think doing things that support healthy democracy are certainly one step to fighting dark money in politics. Of course, I think everyone's familiar with voting, with expressing a free speech. But also, there are a lot of different ways we see climate action come through. It's not just happening at a federal level in Congress. You can take part in your local community to push for climate progress. And one campaign that we've seen really replicate and proliferate around the country is fighting for clean electricity to power buildings. And that's something people can fight for at the more local level, and I think is a great example of ways people can take more ownership in the climate crisis.
Yes, I have Adam, who's on YouTube right now, watching this discussion. And Adam says, what changes can the US make to limit or prevent corporate lobbying in support of oil and gas? Charlie, was it you that said that there were 10,000 lobbyists?
Yes, registered lobbyists.
Registered.
On top of that, you have unregistered lawyers, PR firms, a whole suite of consultants. I mean, it's yeah. it's, you know, a zoo of corporate influence in Washington, D.C. It's kind of a Frankenstein monster that deregulating campaign finance, as well as, you know, the growth of think tanks and other front groups that corporations fund. So it's quite a juggernaut. You know, for instance, dark money itself, which is political spending on campaigns. I think the statistic that I read recently is that there was about $5 million spent back in 2006 through dark money groups on that cycle of elections. In the latest 2020 cycle, it was up to $1 billion. The woman in the blockade video mentioned oligarchs, and she's absolutely right. Well, we have people talk about oligarchs from Russia and other countries. What we have are 700 plus billionaires in the United States. Many of them are fossil fuel billionaires, multi-billionaires like Charles Koch. And when you think about it, these are people who, like, you know, oligarchs who hide their money offshore through secret accounts and various structures. These guys are hiding their money through channels to influence politics and policy. And essentially, they too are kleptocrats. But in this case, what they're stealing is democracy and our chance of a livable future.
So, Charlie, are you saying that this is so big it's too difficult to tackle?
No, we have, you know, this is why they opposed the Freedom to Vote Act, which was a very strong bill. It's been called the strongest civil rights bill in 50 years. Joe Manchin was an obstacle to it. But that bill is an amalgamation of some of the greatest policies we can enact, including public financing of elections, which is already the case in about 14 states and over 20 cities or towns have public financing of election. We know what the solutions are. Better registration, you know, the kinds of things that we have seen pioneered in states across the country. So it can be done. Again, it's a matter of political will.
Yeah, I'm just looking at... Yes, Rebecca, then Michael.
Oh, just like Charlie says, I think the supporting initiatives that support healthy, functioning democracy is really crucial. I think just to connect the dots, why democratic initiatives are so important here. The majority of the public in the U.S. certainly supports climate action. What we see repeatedly for decades now is it's a minority of concentrated special interests where the wealth is that are fighting to block these kinds of laws. Mm-hmm. So if we have better representation in the system, that we have better access to voting, that means we have a better shot at climate action.
Michael.
Yeah, what Rebecca just said is right on point. Look, we have a situation right now. We have a system with the filibuster where a minority of politicians, and reflecting a very small minority of the American people, can prevent any action on any of the items that we've talked about, and in particular, legislation to rein in dark money. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who's been a real leader, a Democrat from Rhode Island, who's been a real leader here, you know, has produced, you know, legislation, but it needs now 60 votes to pass the Senate. And so to do anything about, you know, dark money, we now need 60 Democratic votes or 50 Democrats who are willing to find workarounds to deal with the filibuster problem. And right now, those two holdouts that we talked about, Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, have been obstacles to changing the filibuster rules so that, again, that small minority cannot prevent action on any of these items that we're talking about. So once again, the solution is collective action. It's people turning out to vote in every election, not just the presidential elections or the midterm elections, but the off-term elections, so that we get the representation necessary to move these sorts of bills forward and you know, take back our system from polluters and moneyed interests.
You know, Femi, I wanted to point out, because your audience is international, and we've been talking about, you know, United States government, but it struck me back when the Paris Accord was being negotiated that when John Kerry was taking it there, they had to turn it into an agreement and not a treaty. And why is that? Because he knew he couldn't bring it back to the United States with a Republican-controlled Senate and get it ratified as a treaty. So that's why, you know, when we talk a lot about the U.S. Congress as an institution that really is obstructing global action on climate change, we really mean it.
I want to pick up on that thought, because we've got John Paul Jose, who we spoke to. He's a climate and environmental justice advocate. He is based in India, and he looks to the United States as being an example, a model for what climate action can achieve. And to date, it hasn't been a very good model. Here he is.
In the middle of a long delay in climate action, even the slightest possible actions are considered as a turning point in the fight against the climate crisis. These actions brings hopes to people who are impacted by climate crisis in their everyday life, especially those from vulnerable regions. This is where lobbying comes as a surprise strike in delaying or hampering the progress in immediate climate actions, which tend to ensure climate justice. When such lobbying comes from a so-called global leader, the title of polluter suits them most than being a leader.
So, Michael, I'm just thinking about how many U.S. administrations have said that we are committed to climate action and failed to deliver. Then there was the one Trump administration that said we are not, and we are not delivering, and they were way more successful than any of the administrations that said, yes, we do believe in climate change, and we do believe we need to actually take action. Thoughts, Michael?
Well, I mean, during the Trump years, we saw states and localities step up in the absence of any leadership. I mean, Donald Trump literally became the only head of state to threaten and indeed follow through in pulling out of the Paris Agreement. So that was a huge setback. The previous administration, the Obama administration, had seen some real successes, a bilateral agreement with China that led to the Paris Agreement and led to some actionable commitments from the major polluters of the world to really do something. And then there was this setback. When the United States refuses to lead, as we saw during the Trump administration, then other countries like India and China, you know, they ease up in their efforts as well. And so American leadership is essential. We're seeing that under the Obama administration. The problem right now, of course, is obstruction by congressional Republicans and a very small number of Democrats who have enabled their efforts to block the Biden administration's agenda on climate. And so once again, it comes down to turning out in elections and electing politicians who will act on our behalf rather than on the behalf of polluters. One other point I'd like to make. We've talked a lot about the United States, but there are some other petrostates, Russia in particular, which has, you know, built its wealth and its influence off our reliance on their fossil fuels and Europe's reliance on their fossil fuels. And they're now using that as a cudgel to prevent any sanctions from being taken against them over their actions in Ukraine. So this is really a reminder. The fact that we've propped up these petrostates like Saudi Arabia and Russia is a reminder of one of the other real costs of our continued dependence on fossil fuels and why it's so important for us to get off fossil fuels.
Mm. One more thought here from YouTube, and I'm going to ask you to do this very quickly for me, Charlie. Fergal says, this conversation is not that simple. All companies are energy companies, and they're using oil profits today to fund renewable energy projects for our future. I have heard that so many times. Charlie, your instant response back is what?
It's pennies on the dollar. I mean, it's true that some of the companies invest in, let's say, Koch Industries, the largest private oil and gas company in the United States, is investing a little bit in batteries because they know that the market for oil and gas is going away in transportation.
Thanks, Charlie.
And they better hedge their bet.
All right, Charlie and Rebecca and Michael, thank you for wrestling with this complex subject on the stream. We really appreciate you. Audience, have a look here on my laptop. This program was part of the Covering Climate Now series. You can follow it always on coveringclimatenow.org for the latest on the climate crisis. Thanks for watching.